Well, in answering the question about the Counseling and Behavioral Studies Department, in 62, 63, mm-hmm. we were completing the last phase of the reorganization of the School of Education.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, we talked about it, and we had the old Department of Education, then there was the Department of Ed Psych and the Department of Ed Administration, and the Department of Education.
Right.
And then that Department of Education broke into three departments: Department of Curriculum and Instruction, Department of Educational Policy Studies, and the Department of Counseling and Behavioral Studies. And the units that were in that Department of Counseling and Behavioral Studies were what's now Counseling and Guidance, Special Education, and Rehabilitation Counseling.
Mm-hmm.
I was the first chairman of that,
mm-hmm.
and I think in all honesty, the best way to say that is that we were together as a department for 3 years. We really never built departmental programs.
Mm-hmm.
We were an administrative vehicle for three separate programs. Basically, that organizational structure and that union of those three units was decreed by Mr. Stiles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after Mr. McCarty became dean, it became apparent that he had some different viewpoints on structure and about organizational structure, and we requested a separate department. We asked the Rehabilitation Counseling Unit to join with us in the department. They thought that their emphasis was more on the disability than it was on the intervention strategies, and so they chose to stay with special education. And so in 67, I think it was, then the Department of Counseling and Guidance was formed, and the Department of Studies and Behavioral Disability was formed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we became an independent faculty of just Counseling and Guidance at that particular time. I can't speak for them. I do know that I think it was a good move for us in the sense that we were able to build departmental programs. We were able to have much more consensus about curriculum, about examinations, about those kinds of things. And so it made us a smaller administrative unit, which has both advantages and disadvantages. On the other, and it separated us, you know, made more administrative units and more discrete units,
mm-hmm.
which, if you're inclined, can really isolate you. We're not inclined to do that. Our curriculum has pretty consistently maintained itself for our majors. About half of their studies are in this department, and about half of their studies are elected out of other departments, either within the School of Education and predominantly Ed Psych, in curriculum and instruction, or else in letters and sciences units in psychology and sociology. Those are the departments that we use the greatest frequency. So that's that. I think one of the big places of disagreement internally within the faculty focused around two areas. One was the whole business of admissions when we were the Counseling and Behavioral Studies Department,
mm-hmm.
and the other was around the whole business of agreement on comprehensive exams, both for the master's degree and the PhD. The special education area had a pretty good sized undergraduate enrollment, and that aspect of the program was pretty much allowed to develop the way that they wanted it to develop. It was in the graduate aspects of the program where we had the greater disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we had all that much disagreement in terms of personnel, in terms of personnel functioning, and in terms of rules and regulations of that type. It focused more on the delivery system for the educational programs.
Mm-hmm. A couple things come to mind.
First of all, I was reading in the EdSych files the other day, and I discovered that EdSych discourages their students from having internal graduate minors, or their external graduate minors, in other departments in the School of Education. And you're saying a lot of your students do their work within the School of Education. Has that ever been a problem, or how does that go in this department? That is, do you encourage students to take more within education, or has that ever been something of consideration?
We haven't got caught up in that. We've basically looked at other departments in the School of Education as any department. They're independent departments, and if that's an appropriate outside department minor for a major in this department, why fine and dandy. If it isn't, why then another choice. I would guess, and it's strictly a guess, I don't have any figures for this at all other than in my head, and as it focuses on the people, the doctoral students that I've chaired, I would think that probably it's about 50-50 in this department of people having their outside minor in some other department than within the School of Education, or and predominantly in our case it would be psychology or sociology. Those would be the dominant departments. In recent years, in the last few years, we've had a larger number of students getting their outside department in the home management and family living course courses, and in that particular department. And some of that is because of the focus on working with families and marriage counseling, things of that type. But if it's appropriate for a student to have his outside minor in ed psych, why fine and dandy. That's another department.
When well, since you've now been the chairman in this department, this counseling and behavioral studies department, you were chairman of the old education department.
Yeah, I was chairman of the counseling and guidance department.
Right. Maybe you can give a little bit of insight into the different operations of those three departments in terms of, you know, how reorganization affected them and how the passage of time and the restructuring of university bureaucracy has affected the freedom of the chair to operate and the independence of the departments.
Well, let me start with the old Department of Education. That was a big department. I don't remember exactly what the count was of professorial staff, but it was humongous. Really big department. And it was at a big growth expansion time within the university and within the School of Education. It was at a time in history when we had lots of outside support money. We had grants all over the place. Administratively, from a chairman's standpoint, it was easy and it was difficult. It was easy in that an awful lot of determination and an awful lot of decision-making, the greatest share of decision-making was within the department, and with very little interference from the standpoint of decision-making external to the department. It was a difficult administrative year because we were operating under the Department of Education and we were reorganizing and establishing three new departments. So in effect, there was, in the second semester of that year, there were times that I was acting as chairman of four departments because in terms of the legal machinery of the university, I was the acting chair of the three new departments that were being formed, and I was the chair of the department that was going out of existence.
In 1962.
This is 62, 63, yeah. So that was, that presented a lot of administrative hassles for me as an individual, just because I was trying to accommodate so many people in so many different structures and we were trying to get policies established, and you had the whole business of getting your degree programs sanctioned. You had divisional committee things that you had to go through, those kinds of things. The following year, I was chairman of the Department of Counseling and Behavioral Studies. I think the same thing prevailed as far as being a chairman is concerned, in that there was a lot of decision making that was basically within the department. We had organizational problems, and we had some things that we had to work on. We had to work on our rules and regulations. We had to work on our policy manual. We had a lot of internal things to work on getting our own department underway. We had, I've already alluded to the constant struggle that we had within that body regarding curriculum and regarding exams, those kinds of things. The next time that I was chairman was 72 to 75, which is a decade later. And administration of the department was an entirely different ballgame, because by this time we'd become part of the unified University of Wisconsin system. We were no longer the University of Wisconsin, which was just the Madison campus at that time. And that has posed, as far as I'm concerned, posed a lot of issues in being a department chairman.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of departmental autonomy has been eroded, that there's more levels of administration to be accountable to. It's not just the unification of the system, however. It used to be, for example, we would have a staff opening. You would announce the position, you would seek candidates, and you would interview, and you made a decision about the staff member you wanted, and you hired that person. Lord, now you've got to keep records of everyone that applies, of everyone that you interview. If you don't hire a minority person or a female, you've got to make all kinds of justifications for the hiring process. In hiring TAs, for example, in this day and age, you got a labor management contract that exists between the TA Association and the university. And you've got all those machinations to attend to when you want to make appointments. There's just a lot more that is legislated for you in terms of what you can do administratively a decade later than there was a decade earlier. And the issue for me is that it's taken away from the faculty, and it's taking away from the department chairman professional prerogatives that they used to have. And I think it's made the chairman much less of an educational leader and much more of an administrative handyman.
Mm-hmm. Do you find...
I hope, to be honest with you, and you can quote that, I hope I never have to be department chairman again.
Mm-hmm.
We have a rotational system. In fact, there's a statute on the books for the rules and regulations of the university that says department chairman will be elected annually.
Mm-hmm.
And so there can be a turnover of chairman every year. In our department, that hasn't been the case. Ordinarily, when a person has been selected for the chairmanship, he's had the post for 3 years. But the chairman's generally glad to get out from underneath that responsibility at the end of 3 years. And most people that have had it don't look forward to having it a second time. And I've had it 3 times, and so I'm not looking forward to performing in that function again. It may turn out that I am obligated to do that, but I'm sure not requesting it.
Now, although you served as chairman of these other two departments at rather peculiar times in their histories, I get the impression that you're saying, as well as other things, that the amount of time taken up in doing the chairman's ordinary duties is greater now than it has been in the past. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think, that one year, no, because... But that was a very unusual circumstance. In general, though, the way I've seen Mr. Sanborn and Mr. Dilley function and the things that they've had to contend with, the things that I know that I had to contend with from 72 to 75, that there's just plain more mechanical things as a department chairman to be contending with than there was a decade ago. There's no question in my mind about that. And it takes away from other aspects of productivity. But you know that. When you're elected chairman, you know that half of your time at least is going to be devoted to the administrative function. And when you get down to the nitty-gritty of decision-making internally within the department and negotiation with the dean regarding the merit for the person that is serving within the... chairmanship, why he doesn't get penalized in terms of his salary for being chairman and not doing the other kinds of things that are more characteristically thought of as the productivity of a university professor, such as the teaching and the writing and the research and those kinds of things.
Has it also tended to take away more time from the faculty as a whole, or is this primarily been seen just in the chairman's position, just piling on of more detailed administrative functions?
Oh, I think there's more of it. There's more forms to fill out. There's more things of that type to be contended with. That's the reality, so.
Yeah, it's always, I don't know. Okay. One thing that you seem to indicate is that the structuring of the administrative hierarchy is thicker than it used to be, and that it is more insistent that you go through each channel properly. For instance, I have read that even before this unified system, that if one examined the university's administration on paper and followed all the steps throughout to get from one end to the other, you can go through an extremely involved process. However, I get the impression that it was in the past a little easier to make end runs and to cut through some of these formal steps, and that's not so true now. Is that an accurate perception?
I don't know whether I can respond to that, the way you phrased it.
Okay.
We used to get a budget.
Mm-hmm.
And we got budget in two forms. We got budget that was personnel budget, and we got supplies and expense budget. Now, you've never been able to move money from one budget to the other, and you still can't. But take the personnel budget as a case in point. We would get so much money every new budget time that was allocated for merit. And we had the power of determination within the department of how that money was to be allocated. In the last several years, the legislature has decreed how we will allocate that money. They've said, for example, that so much of it would be given across the board, and what remains can be utilized for merit.
So they've fixed your budget function.
So the budget function is fixed externally to the department. Now, there's always been certain guidelines and certain constraints, certain controls, that doesn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
Or let me answer it another way. It used to be that you had the lowest level of administration is the department. Then you go to the dean, and then you went to the campus administration, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the department is still the lowest level of administration. You go to the dean goes to the campus administration, and the campus administration has to go to the next budgetary level, has to go to the next level of administration, which is the university administration.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then another aspect of this is probably at the same level as far as state organization would look, is the Department of Administration, which is a downtown operation. But the Department of Administration has imposed a lot more regulations and constraints of one kind or another in terms of the whole budgetary process, which ultimately affects the administrative process.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean in terms of administrative units that you're accountable to. And you realize it very potently at this level, because DOA wants information, the campus wants information, and the university level wants administration. Mm-hmm. And that, so you get this request for information, you get this request for information, you get this request for information. Sometimes it's almost the same piece of information, and it looks at this level of administration as though the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's requesting.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the higher levels of the campus administration have done enough or insisted enough on the fact that, well, defended the department's position that the legislature is taking away their prerogatives concerning the budget?
I can't answer that. I can't answer that. I can appreciate the problems of administration, however, at the university level, in that, what are there, I don't know how many different campuses there are, but there's 13, 15 degree granting campuses besides the two-year campuses. And one of the issues that they have as administrators at that level is to, quotes, not show favoritism, is to have policy that goes across campuses and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Where we used to be an independent campus, we're no longer an independent campus, and we get caught up in all of the machinations that go on when you're not an independent administrative unit and you're only one administrative unit within a much larger administrative pie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we are now.
Do you think that...
I, for one, don't think that this campus has been enhanced at all by the unified University of Wisconsin system.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that you could, within your own department, point to anything specific that this unified system has done to hinder your operation or in any way hurt the quality of the program or make it more difficult for you to keep your program at the level that you thought it was at before? No.
Not in terms of the program in and of itself. It's some of the tangential things that are more at stake and are more of a nuisance.
Mm-hmm.
Not in terms of the instruction, not in terms of the actual delivery of the program to students.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we've either been hindered or helped mm-hmm. by the unified system.
Okay. It hasn't changed the way the faculty has been making perceptions about the selection of new faculty or the selection of incoming students in any way, which you can see.
Not, I don't know as a result of the unified system. I do know this, that when I first came here on this faculty in 1958, more than 50%. In fact, I believe if we were to go and dig out the data, it would probably be more than 60% of our graduate students, and particularly doctoral students in our department, were out-of-state students.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of legislative action, and I don't knows this as much as the unified system as it was of the protest years of the late 60s. The out-of-state tuition has just been raised and raised and raised and raised and raised, and we've become a much more provincial campus, overall campus, and a much more provincial department.
Mm-hmm.
We have, to be honest with you, we have a hell of a time recruiting out-of-state students.
Mm-hmm.
More so at the master's level than we do at the doctor level, because being just a graduate department, we have some, when we have outside grants or we have money to support students, we have to give most of that money and do give most of that money to doctoral students. But we lose some excellent master's students just because we don't have money support for them or we don't have appointment support. You see, where rules and regulations of university are that if a TA, a PA, or an RA has a third time or more assistantship appointment, he gets a waiver of out-of-state fees.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of departments have discussion sections and that kind of thing taught by graduate students, which includes both master's and doctoral students.
Right.
But they have undergraduates. These are undergraduate sections.
Right.
And so master's students get a PA position, can get a waiver of out-of-state fees. We're just a graduate department. We don't have any undergraduate sections. And you don't allow master's students to teach master's students.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, we get in a real bind in this department in terms of recruiting out-of-state master's students particularly. I don't know that that's related in any way, however, to the stem of your question, which was the unified system. That's more in terms of legislative action.
That's helpful, though.
But we're, our student body is much more reflective of just Wisconsin students in this day and age than it was 15 years ago. Much more so. And I see that as negative, because I think to get people from all different areas has a really good salutary effect on broadening the experience of people in the program. They bring in different ideas, they bring in different territorial, sociological, status ideas. New England isn't Wisconsin and neither is New Mexico.
Right.
And so it just gives a more cosmopolitan flavor to the discussion, to the intermix that you have among your students.
Mm-hmm. One thing I had also noted down was that you mentioned about how the different deans have viewed the guidance program here and how they've varied in their support for it. Has there been any real difference?
Well, Mr. Stiles had a different philosophy about what guidance and counseling was than what Mr. McCarty had and what I perceived Mr. Palmer having. On the other hand, in terms of support for faculty, in terms for program building, program expansion, those kinds of things, all three of them have been very supportive within the constraints of their office. In effect, when I came here in 58, there were two full-time faculty members in counselor education, Mr. Rothney and myself. We got outside support money through National Defense Education Act, Titles IV and Titles V. We added staff in connection with those programs, first on soft money basis, but there was constant moving of people into hard money status. Stiles supported this, McCarty supported this, Mr. Palmer supported this. I think that our area has been a productive area as far as the school of education is concerned. All three of the deans like productivity on the part of their faculty, whether it's our faculty or someone else's. We have a good reputation. Our program has a good reputation. It gets rated very high by user publics when they talk about our products. So in that sense, I think the department has a good reputation. Within reason and within the possibilities that the dean has, if we have a request to make, he'll give it a good hearing, and I know that McCarty gave it a good hearing, and I know that Stiles gave it a good hearing. So, although they have different philosophies, as I say, I think Mr. Stiles saw guidance and counseling work fundamentally in a sort of a recovery problem solution attitude, whereby Mr. McCarty and Mr. Palmer support our view that guidance and counseling work is best seen in preventive developmental models.
You have to repeat a little bit of the last part.
Well, ever since I've been here, we've always had more people that wanted to come to this program than we could accept in light of the faculty manpower we had or the scope of the program. So that we're refusing people as enrollees.
Mm-hmm.
We're able to be selective. I think we've selected good people. In the main, they've gone out and been able to be hired for top grade positions in other institutions.
Mm-hmm.
We have requests. We have some service courses that we offer. We never have difficulty in most instances filling the service courses. So I think we have a pretty good reputation, not only internally within the School of Education, but externally in the remainder of the campus in terms of some of our instructional activities and functions. We've had we've had four of our faculty that have had major offices in professional associations.
Mm-hmm.
We've had people that have been on editorial boards. We have people that are constantly called upon to be consultants to other institutions, not just educational institutions. For example, we have three faculty members that have been delivering training programs for a major insurance company for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
We have summer workshops. They go out on and deliver instructional programs all over the country and outside the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is just a case in point. We're a well-published faculty. That doesn't mean that we don't have issues and problems and shortcomings.
Mm-hmm. I was just asking about the different deans and how they, if there was any variance. Sounds like there's not.
Well, they're a different administrative style. Mr. Stiles is a real proactive dean. He's a real go-getter. He was constantly reaching out. I saw Mr. McCarty as being much more of a consolidation, administratively a consolidation dean, and I think we needed that at that time. Mr. Stiles put an awful lot of new things in motion, and there comes a time that you can put too many things in motion and it's necessary and desirable to consolidate the gains. You can't be climbing the ladder all the time. Every once in a while, you better get out on the platform and see what it is that you've got.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw Mr. McCarty as that kind of a dean. I guess I see Mr. Palmer as sort of a mix of those two. I haven't had as much administrative involvement with Mr. Palmer as I had with either McCarty or with Mr. Stiles.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'll say this. As a department chairman, maybe some of it was because of some of the activities that were going on at the time, but Mr. Stiles called a lot more frequently than did either Mr. McCarty or Mr. Palmer.
Mm-hmm. That seems good. Going on to a somewhat different area, I was curious about how the counseling program, as it has existed here, has been influenced by and been a part of the Wisconsin Improvement Program.
Well, in the early phases of the Wisconsin Improvement Program, we weren't involved at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. That was fundamentally directed toward teacher education, period. In 1968, the certification law was changed in Wisconsin regarding school counselors, and it included at that particular time an internship possibility, and the law read that experimental internships were possible. And we made a decision to offer a program that allowed students coming into the program to go either way for school counseling. And it's at that particular time that we became involved with the Wisconsin Improvement Program and are involved with the Wisconsin Improvement Program at this time.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the WIP program was fundamentally set up with the internship idea. And so over the last 10 years, we've had some involvement with the Wisconsin Improvement Program. We do now. We publicity regarding internships and is sent out through WIP program. Mr. Stoltenberg alerts institutions that we have a counseling internship, those kinds of things. So we have the usual, as near as I know, we have the same kind of working relationship with WIP now than any other department would have.
Mm-hmm. It's somewhat tangential to this, but since you are primarily a graduate department, I think solely a graduate department, has there been a feeling that the nature of counseling and the sorts of relationships the counseling has to ordinary teachers and the teacher training program has been adequate in the last 15 or 20 years in the school, or do you think that more needs to be done or more used to be done concerning training teachers about the relationships with counselors and so on and so forth?
We'll have some people in this department that will be students in this department that will not have very much, I should say, contact with other aspects of education.
Mm-hmm.
It's because they're going toward agency work or private practice or things of that type.
Mm-hmm.
Those people that are going to work in educational institutions, which is still the largest number of students in this department, both on the basis of certification law as well as competencies that we would feel that they have to have, will have coursework involvement in administration and in curriculum and instruction.
Right. I guess what I was asking was that for people, undergraduates, who are not in your department but are being trained to be school teachers, do you think that your department has had an adequate involvement in their training so that when they get out to schools that they relatively easily can work out relationships with school counselors and know how that position functions and so on and so forth? That's absolutely.
We have no organized tie Mm-hmm. It's curriculum and instruction. If a student has any kind of guidance input from this faculty as an undergraduate, it's generally because he or she and his and her advisor help them to elect either the 600 course or the 650 course or the 670 course, which are open to upper division undergraduates. Mm-hmm. Now, we get a lot of people who are enrolled in the curriculum instruction department taking those three courses, but it's nothing that is set up in terms of a liaison between this faculty and CNI faculty.
But it does happen. In other
it
words.
Happens.
Yeah.
I can express bias.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that in the actual operation of schools, that all teachers have a guidance function to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that there ought to be formal guidance, input, and study in every teacher's preparation.
Mm-hmm.
Just like I believe that there needs to be at least minimal input regarding curriculum in every school counselor's preparation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we control that, and certification controls that also. Actually, we get more administrators. We know that we're going to get more administrators taking some elective work and guidance than we do classroom teachers, because the certification law requires people that are going to be certified as either principals or superintendents to have formal study and guidance. The law does not require them to have formal study and guidance if you're going to be certified as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So that has some bearing on the enrollment.
Moving on, I guess, to a quite different area. Maybe you can say a word about sort of the nature of research in this department since you've been here, and perhaps highlight any significant changes in direction from the original emphasis in research that existed at the time you came here.
Well, the major research that was going on when I came here in 58 was Mr. Rothney's research in, at that particular time, in guidance and counseling practices with superior students. That thrust still maintains. Where it used to be called the Research and Guidance Laboratory for Superior Students, it's now called GIFS, Guidance Institute for Talented Students.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic intent of, and the basic function, the basic activity is very, very similar. So that thread of research has been continuous in the department.
Mm-hmm.
After Mr. Rothney, well, Rothney introduced it, and when Sanborn came on the faculty in 63, he became the associate director of the lab and worked with Rothney on that. And later on, Marshall became the director of that lab, and Mr. Palvino, when he came on the faculty in 71, moved into working in the lab. Palvino still has an involvement with the lab. Dr. Sanborn is into other activities now, and 2 years ago, Mr. Perrone took over director of the lab. So there's been different faculty members that have had major investment in that function, but the thesis of the guidance and counseling of gifted and talented people has been a research activity that's gone across those years. Remember, in 58, we were just a faculty of two,
mm-hmm.
and I was new on the faculty. Well, one of the things that I've been constantly interested in is the whole business of the selection of people who study in a department such as this. And so my research effort and activity has been much has been in the area of counselor selection and counselor education in and of itself. When Mr. Perrone came on the faculty, he's very much into career development and career education and career development, things of that type. And so we've had that thread going into it. When Dr. Hosford was on the faculty, he was a behaviorist and into behavior modification and all that kind of thing. And so there was a big thrust in research and scholarly activities in the area of behaviorism and behavior modification. Dr. Walit, when she came on the faculty, she came when Mr. Rothney retired. She's very much into all of the issues and problems that are associated with counseling and guidance work with girls and women. And so most of her work is directed in that vein.
Is the behaviorism thrust still present in the department?
Not very much. Not very much. Mr. Palvino, for example, in recent years has become very, very interested in parapsychological phenomenon. And so a lot of his inquiry and looking at things has been in the area of parapsychological activities. Mr. Lee has become very interested and very involved in the whole arena of biofeedback and things of that type. So where at one particular time the research interest 20 years ago was a very narrow focus and fundamentally in guidance and counseling of superior and talented people with a belief that if this had generalizable implications for counseling and guidance with everybody, there's a lot more varied thrust in terms of scholarly activity and investigations that are taking place.
Has there been any change in the emphasis on the various analytic tools that you might use for these different areas? But as I'm thinking, is, for instance, is there more emphasis on quantitative techniques now? I mean, that seems to be in some ways a trend in the social sciences. Has that affected your department, or have you gone through phases of that?
Yeah, we've gone through phases of it, up and down. I think we're on a down swing on that right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of, it's not just within this department, I think it's within the whole counseling and guidance field, in that there's some realization that not everything can be quantified and statistics lie sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly when you're dealing in an area that has its prime emphasis on individuality and on the individual, just the minute you throw that data into a group situation, you wash out some of the significant variables and the significant interconnections that exist. And so there's more work now and moving back to case study research,
mm-hmm.
Things of that type. I think there's another trend we're seeing in some of our dissertations and some of the interests of our doctoral students is that there's a swing back to some real interest in fundamental theoretical activity too. And so it rises and falls with national trends as well as
has there been a change in other academic disciplines that you tend or may look to borrow paradigms from, that is anthropology or sociology, or does it always tend to be internally generated? Or
it's influenced by other fields. It's influenced by psych, by anthropology, by sociology, by the field itself, so it's a mix.
There's not been any trend there that you would say you perceive as each individual's mix of it as they find it useful for them.
You mean within the department?
Right.
Yeah.
In terms of the kinds of research that you've been able to conduct in the department, has federal money played an important role in what you've been able to do and not do?
Sure.
In what way?
Well, you don't get very much in the way of state budgeted money in your budget for research.
Mm-hmm.
you get some. But most of the research money is in terms of professorial ingenuity and creativity and persistence and getting monies from the federal government, from foundations, from things of that type. Mm-hmm. And so the majority of, I don't think that's any different in this department than any other department.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have a portion of the budget that we have for the Guidance Institute is in terms of state money. Mm-hmm. And so we finance, every year we finance X number of research assistants through state support money. But that state support money is really seed money, is a very important seed money, and I hope we never lose that seed money. Mm-hmm. But when a lot of times in grants or foundations, you have to show where there's university contribution to a certain percentage in relation to the amount of money that will be given to you from outside, from soft money sources.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's inevitably a consideration.
Has the creation of federal programs, which have been beginning with NDEA, very extensive, I would say, in the counseling area, has that tended to push the department in areas of research more to the government's interests than to the faculty's interests?
No.
Hasn't been a problem that way.
Well, yes and no, in the sense of the very seldom does the federal government sponsor general support.
Mm-hmm.
Most all federal support, whether it's for instruction, whether it's for research, whether what it's for,
mm-hmm.
and it's not just limited to education. It's the whole universe. It's right. Categorical aid.
Right.
Most all federal legislation is categorical aid.
Do you find that this, that the phrasing of grants and so on, the money that's made available has been changed in any way? Like I spoke with Mr. Heber, and my understanding from him was that in his area, that there in recent years has been a tendency that the sorts of specifics about, you know, the way the research has to be done and so on and so forth has been sharpened up so that there's less freedom perhaps for the faculty.
Yeah, you better know what the legislation reads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Right now, for example, there's guidance money in ESEA, Elementary and Secondary Education Act. There's money in Vocational Education Act, and there's money in the Career Development Act.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the three major sources of money in at least related to education. On the other hand, we can get money from NIMH. We can get money from NIE.
Mm-hmm.
You can get money from foundations.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, foundations don't put as many constraints as the federal government sources do. If you want money from the Career Education Act, somehow the research that you're going to do or the instructional program that you're going to deliver has somehow got to get in the whole notion of career education.
Mm-hmm.
Your own ingenuity allows you to request that either in a very restricted way or in a very broad way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another of the large areas of research literally research and development is the R&D center that's been developed here. How much contact does this department maintain with that center, if any? And
they have very little involvement with them. Okay. Even when we were housed in that building, we didn't have all that much involvement.
Is that by design or accident? Just offhand, I would think that you might have considerable interaction with that sort of project, or at least could. For instance, I mean, when they developed their IGE program, I could see counseling being developed as a part of that entire program. for instance.
Right. So could I, but we haven't had that much involvement with them. Uh-huh.
Okay, there have been a number of changes or so on and so forth in the student body and students you've had, but perhaps you can make a few other additions in your viewpoint of the changes or the nature of the students you've been attracting to your program over the last 20 years.
Well, when I first came here, I think 95% of the students that were in the program were interested in schools.
Mm-hmm.
That was doctoral population as well as master's students. And the largest number of them were interested somehow in relation to secondary schools. That was Mr. Rothney's fundamental commitment. And he was the dominant person. When I came into the program, why, I'm not that restricted.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of my influence came to bear after a while, where I look at guidance and counseling out of a developmental perspective and think there's just as important a place for guidance and counseling in the elementary school as there is in the secondary school, or as there is in the college, university, or as far as that's concerned, for people in middle age. But, and people in age, what, 5 through 25 are fundamentally accommodated through educational institutions. Once you get beyond 25, the accommodations for guidance and counseling work are going to come in institutions other than schools. They're going to come through community agencies. They're going to be come through governmental agencies. It's going to come through people that are involved in private practice.
Mm-hmm.
And as we selected the faculty, they had some of these broader interests. We have people. We don't have a single faculty member now that's not interested in guidance and counseling as it's implemented in educational institutions at some level or other. Some are more interested in higher education than they are elementary or secondary. Mr. Sanborn is very basically through and through a school person,
mm-hmm.
as a case in point. I think Mr. Prone is probably got 60% of his commitment from a standpoint of being a school person. I would say that I've probably got 60% of my commitment as an educational person. Not school person necessarily, college and university as much as it. But the other 40% is in terms of other people within the whole life space chronological aid period. And if I'm going to be interested in people in late 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, then the delivery of guidance and counseling activities and interventions is going to occur someplace other than in school, other educational institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that because of some of the things that I'm interested in, and I'm very much the architect of what this current curriculum is.
Mm-hmm.
Rothney was never very interested in going through the machinations of curriculum building. He was very supportive and very involved, but he wasn't interested in taking the leadership of that. And I was, and so that was something that I took on when I came on in this faculty. And so one of the changes, one of the major changes, is moving away from just emphasis of people being employed in secondary schools, people that are products of our program, being employed in secondary schools, or being employed in college and universities where they were training people for secondary schools, is it's broadened. Now, the counseling psych option is part and parcel of that. We could have gone to APA years and years and years ago to, quotes, have an approved program in counseling psychology. We didn't. We're in the process of doing that now. That doesn't mean we haven't been preparing counseling psychologists for some period of time. I look up there and I see the name of doctoral students. There's one up there that graduated in 1965, and he's been a licensed consulting psychologist in the state of Michigan almost ever since he graduated. That's 14 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we've had people that have gone through, if you will, a counseling psych type of preparation program. They've been licensed, and they've been in private practice. They do those kind of things across the year, but it's just now that we're going through the formal stages of having a visitation and having ourselves identified as a, quote, formal approved program in counseling psychology. Mm-hmm. Every faculty member in this department either is or has been a member of the Division of Counseling Psychology of the American Psychological Association. Mm-hmm. I'm a fellow in Division 17. I'm the only one on the faculty that is in this department. There are three of us that are licensed psychologists in the state of Wisconsin. None of us are in private practice. We fundamentally are licensed for the purpose of supporting students and students being able to say when they, if they're going in that direction, to say they've been supervised by licensed psychologists. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to be in private practice. I don't want to be in private practice. Mm-hmm. Yet it's critical sometimes for students to say they work with a counseling psychologist. Yeah.
Have the students been coming primarily from the same pre-background, you know, or training as in the past?
I have to answer that yes and no. Uh-huh. I think probably the first 4 or 5 years that I was here, maybe a little bit longer than that. Predominantly, the students came from an education undergraduate background. That was more true of the master's students than it was the doctoral students. But one of the changes that's occurred over the time that I've been here is the increasing number of people that want to study in this area that come from other backgrounds. Now, predominantly, and I mean predominantly, 90% of them at least, maybe more than 90%, of the people that apply to this department come from one of three undergraduate backgrounds. They mm-hmm. come from some aspect of education, some aspect of psychology, or some aspect of sociology. Mm-hmm. 90% of them. Sociology and psych have picked up because of the change of certification laws. For example, for school counseling, now a person can have an undergraduate psych major come into the department and go through the internship option in our program and become certified as a school counselor, okay? Mm-hmm. Also, there's been a gradual expanding and a growth in conceptualization about counseling psychology as against, say, clinical psychology or social psychology or consulting psychology and some of those. And so on this campus, we're the only department. See, psych doesn't, ed psych doesn't do anything, either one of those don't do anything in the preparation of counselors. Mm-hmm. And so you get people who have undergraduate psych majors but are still looking for an occupational outlet. And so instead of applying to a graduate program in clinical psych or a graduate program in social psych or a graduate program in consulting psych, they apply for a graduate program in counseling psych. Mm-hmm. And so on this campus, we get them. Right. Some other campuses where counseling is, say, in the psych department or the ed psych department, they wouldn't be showing up. So there's been a gradual change in those dimensions. Mm-hmm. And part of it's certification law, part of it's other kinds of trends. Some of it's a broadening perspective about counseling, counseling psych, and things of that type. So. Mm-hmm.
Are the students coming in with about the same amount of outside experience now as they were in the past, that is, having gone out and had some experience in teaching or so on and so forth? Or is that, how does that work?
Well, that varies. Mm-hmm. And it even varies now. It varies by year. And I don't ask me to account for it. Okay. I just can't account for it. I think one of the things that'll happen, I'd be willing to predict that one of the things that'll happen, assuming that we become identified and get published in the American Psychologist as having an approved program in counseling psych.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that'll happen early in that is that we'll get a large number of undergraduate psych majors without very much work experience applying for the program.
Mm-hmm.
We won't take them. We won't take very many of them. Because we've got a, in terms of the expectations for our program, we've got work experience. We take a look at work experience as one of the admissions criteria. And if a person, if everything else is equal and a person's record and one person has got work experience in some human area and another person hasn't and everything else is equal, we'll take the person with work experience.
Mm-hmm.
And we're taking 1 in 5 doctoral applicants now and about 1 in 3 master's applicants, and we're going to get in it with an APA-approved program. I predict we'll get more applicants, and it'll just make the competition for billets that much harder, and people that haven't got work experience won't stand much of a chance of getting in.
Right.
I can tell them that right now, whether we're approved or not approved.
Mm-hmm.
We really won't change that much in terms of operation if APA approves this program. There's going to be people that are going to see differences, and so they're going to apply, and my prediction will be, and it's on the basis of other programs that have gone this route. One of my former doctoral students, our former doctoral students, and I was his chairman, I say my former doctoral students, it's really not right, but is on the faculty at an institution where when he first went there, in about the first 5 or 6 years that he was there, they didn't have an APA-approved program. And about 4 years ago, their program was APA-approved, and that's one of the things that he said happened in their program, is that they got an increasing number of freshly degreed psychology students applying for the program.
Mm-hmm. Have you, over the years, significantly changed your admission criteria for your incoming graduate students? Added things that you didn't require in the past?
We've added things that we didn't require in the past. We've taken away things that we required in the past and didn't require them and then reinstituted them. And we fundamentally admit students on past scholastic achievement.
Mm-hmm.
We take a look at course pattern. We take a look at work experience. We take a look at work recommendations and academic recommendations. We have a career development form that they have to fill out, and we take a look at that. We've required standardized tests. We've not required standardized tests, and we've required standardized tests again, so that's been in the hopper. That's master's people. All of those things apply also to the doctoral population, and we interview doctoral students. We have a journal critique exercise that doctoral students have to contend with.
Mm-hmm.
We've used some of my research interests and research instrumentation that I've worked on across the years on selection and trying to get at the relationship variable that people have. We've used that in varying degrees and at various times, so we're constantly looking at that.
From a very subjective level, how would you describe the nature of student-faculty relations in the time you've been here? That is, in terms of closeness of working relationships and on a more personal basis, on a sort of a more personally evaluative kind of statement.
I think we have pretty consistently had close student-faculty working relations.
Mm-hmm.
We're a small department. We keep our enrollment. We keep a limited enrollment. We have policy within the department that no faculty member is supposed to have more than 7 active doctoral students, sharing more than 7 active doctoral students at any one given time, or more than 9 master students at any one given time.
Mm.
And we've got 8 faculty, so that means that we're pretty consistently going to have less than 70, generally we have less than 60 full-time master students at any one time, and we're someplace around 50 full-time doctoral students most at any one given time. So we got 8 faculty, and we generally run from 110 to 120 active students, which is, and we're all housed within a pretty close area. The whole counseling field is predicated on the importance of interpersonal relationships and human relationships.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that gets in our way sometimes as professors, is that sometimes you get caught up in the whole business of thinking about, rather than a professorial relationship, sometimes a counseling relationship, and that's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Because you still have the evaluative role to carry out as a professor, and sometimes you let that interfere.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have pretty good, close, harmonious working relationships with the student population. On the other hand, it varies.
Mm-hmm.
God, about 5 years ago, we had the most, and I admitted them, I was the admissions chairman at the time, but it was the most cantankerous population in my 20 years here. You couldn't do anything to satisfy it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think in the final analysis, it was the blend of people that we got. There were a couple, three very aggressive, not assertive now.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple, three very aggressive leaders in that group. And it had an impact on the whole group.
Mm-hmm.
And it had an impact on faculty-student relationships. Everybody that's not me, it's a subjective statement I'm giving you, but the whole faculty said, God almighty, what is it with this particular group? And everybody agreed, you know, it was really a cantankerous population. So it varied.
Did you survive each other?
Oh yeah, we survived each other.
Okay. Would you say that the level of your interaction with students was altered in any way by the reorganization that was under the old Department of Education setup? Did that allow for closer ties with students, or because of the size of the department, you tend to sort of lose your students in the morass, or not much effect that way?
I don't think there was much effect that way. In the final analysis, it was a big Department of Education, but people still identified very closely with their major area of inquiry and their major professors, so mm-hmm. I don't see as there was that much difference.
Moving to another area.
Housing, I'll say this though,
mm-hmm.
where we have been housed has had a tremendous impact. There were one time we were at 1815 and 1922 University Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
We were way down there. Another time we were at 400 Babcock Drive, and half of us were there and the other half was over here in the old site building where Helen C. White is now. There's another time that some were in one place and the rest of us were in an old house down now where the LVM Art Center is. So where our offices have been located at various times have had a tremendous impact.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came here, we were in this building. Rothney and I were in this building, in fact, on this floor. And there was very good tie. Then we became spread out. And until we moved into the Ed Sciences building, I forget exactly when that was, but when we moved into the Ed Sciences building, we got back into the central part of the campus and in the major area of the campus, and that was enhancing to better contact between faculty and students. And this year's, of course, you're right in the mainstream of things when you're in this building, and that's been enhancing.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk something about the connection between this department, the intimate connection between this department and the public schools in Wisconsin?
Well, ever since I've been here, there's been a very close tie between the activities going on in this Department of Public Schools, and fundamentally it's been because of the Research and Guidance Laboratory for Superior Students. Rothney established very good working relationships with schools. They were maintained. Polvino, Sanborn, and now Prone have continued with that, so we've had very close ties. I instituted the formal field experience practicum contacts and the placement of school counselors with schools through the internship involvement. This year, for example, through the institute, but in connection, really budgeted through the institute and some of the leadership through the institute, but not necessarily associated with gifted and talented students, we've been conducting workshops throughout the state with program development, what's called program development workshops, that kind of thing. I think we have very good working relationships with public schools.
Mm-hmm.
DPI, we've had very close liaison with DPI over the years that I've been here, and in the last 10 or 12 years, particularly because two of the key people that are in DPI are doctoral students from this department. They've identified with the fact Dick Roth and Bill Erpenbach are the two people I'm talking about. And since Don Severson has come into DPI guidance section, he and Dr. Prone have had very close working relationships. So we have good connections with DPI. Another vehicle that we've had contact with through the schools is that faculty members in our department have been very active in WPGA, Wisconsin Personnel and Guidance Association, which has a predominance of school people as far as its membership, and we've got lots and lots of our own graduates in that association. We've had a lot of our graduates that have had key officer positions in that. Mm-hmm. Some of our own faculty have had key involvement in that. So I think in the main we have good working relationships with the public schools. We've tried to have good working relationships with them. We attend to our PR, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that then, as opposed to perhaps some of the other programs in the school education, particularly some of the undergraduate programs where there's a bit of tugging going on about the requirements that DPI puts upon programs and so on and so forth, you would then say that the kinds of programs that you develop here that involve DPI are in a pretty harmonious way?
In the main. Yeah. Once in a while they get cantankerous with us and we get cantankerous with them.
Right.
Sometimes they...
If not with your friends, then who else?
Huh?
If not with your friends, then who else? So, okay. Very good.
There, and then you can make up your mind. Maybe the dean wants to listen to it. I think the next 10 years are going to show some changes in programs in the School of Education.
Mm-hmm. In such way?
I think some of the programs and some things that are going to happen through this administrative unit are going to reflect working with other kinds of agencies and other kinds of vehicles and schools.
Mm-hmm.
And some of this is going to be because of what the population out there is demanding, and some of it's going to depend on the activity and the visions and the view of faculty. Of saying, well, if we're going to continue to have programs, why, we got to challenge some other agencies other than schools.
Mm-hmm.
Enrollment's dropping.
Mm-hmm.
And if our products, and the products are our students that we graduate.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the important products are students, and those students are going to be going in directions other than schools for employment, that kind of thing, and they're going to need some preparation that's not necessarily thought of within the confines of elementary, secondary schools and colleges and universities.
Mm-hmm.
I think some aspects of this program are a good case in point, is that in 58, probably there wasn't one in 100 that went toward agency work out of this department. No, maybe 20% of it will go toward agency work. And I think that probably in the next 10 years, that may double. And another aspect, just from my own perspective, I think if there's going to be growth and expansion in the field of guidance and counseling, it's not going to be within schools. There's going to be increasing concern for older populations. And how are those people going to be dealt with? They're not going to be dealt with through educational institutions. They're going to be dealt with through other tax-supported vehicles of one kind or another. Call them community agencies. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that this is one area of expansion that this field is going to go toward. And it's going to be, part of it's going to be initiated by professionals, and part of it's going to be demanded by users. And so this will have an impact. And characteristically, probably 90% of the counselor education programs in this country are administered through schools of education.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm saying is I think that schools of education are increasingly going to take on a spectrum of work of where programs are going to be delivered through schools of education, but the education is not going to be for schools.
Learning this so-called lifelong learning aspect.
Yeah.